Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Welcome to season two of the 147 podcast with me, Sports MC Phil Seymour, and him, the reigning players and tour champion and former champion of the world, the magician, Sean Murphy.
Well, we've had a little break from this, haven't we, Sean? We've had a couple of weeks off. Sort of.
A bit like my career. I've had a couple of weeks off.
Oh, let's not say that. No, do you know what? Apologies to those people. I've had quite a few messages from people actually saying, where's the podcast? Why isn't the podcast out? And I did put a social post out last week saying there would be one. Unfortunately, snooker kept Sean busy, and me being the complete and utter numpty that I am, went to work in Aberdeen, left my laptop charger up there. So I wasn't going to pop back to Aberdeen from York just to get my laptop charger. So really, really sorry about that. Unfortunately, we've been unable to do it. But we are back. We are here, Sean. And
we are back.
It's been a busy time for snooker, isn't it?
Busy time's great, though, isn't it? I mean, all jokes aside, I mean, it hasn't been busy for me in terms of playing. I've felt really good going to Cheltenham. I'd done some corporate work beforehand and just, you know, lost another absolute thriller to Jack Lazowski, who played like... How did he play? He played like He-Man on drugs with a free pass. It was just incredible.
Amazing to watch. I mean, as a spectator, great, great match to watch.
I was in with a chance to win the last frame. I overhit the black playing for the last red that I needed. Played a really good safety shot. Absolutely tied him up in knots. I'm praying for him to go for the long red that he did. He drops it in. He drops the black in down the cushion. And of course, from then on, I know it's over. It was an amazing performance. Fast forward to this week in Brentwood. Not such an amazing performance from me. My young opponent did play well. I've heard really good things about him. He played a really good match. He got stronger as I got weaker. I've got a few technical problems in my game at the minute with my equipment. John Paris, the cue magician, was on hand to take my cue immediately after the match. So he's now got my cue for a few days. Hopefully that's going to come back with a full bill of health, and you know, hopefully I can get back on the bike.
Well, just to touch on a couple of things there. Firstly, Lu Hongyu is a talent, isn't he? I mean, he's a real talent. There's quite a few good Chinese players coming through, but he's one that everyone speaks highly of.
Yeah, and as I say, I've done my homework on him. You know, with one foot in the pundits' camp, which I have, as everyone knows. You know, I had done my research on him. I did know he was dangerous. Not to be underestimated. And I have to say, at 2-0 up, everything was rosy. I miscued really badly in the third frame, and it really unsettled me. And the match seemed to turn there. The third frame was, it was horrible and scrappy, and the black blocked one of the pockets. It was like, oh. At one point, it looked like the table was really unlevel because all the balls pushed towards the one side. But it really changed the momentum of the match. But I have to say, he actually played really well. I was in again with a 50-odd, 60-odd break in the last frame, ran out of position, and he stepped in for a very cool, calm and collected counter. And I think definitely one to watch for the future.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, look, let's just have a bit of a recap, because it is, I think, 3 weeks since we put a podcast out, and there's been an awful lot of snooker. I mean, it's feast or famine is snooker at the moment, isn't it? There's either none or there's everything, and currently there's everything, and I think that runs right the way through to the Worlds now, pretty much. So Ronnie won the Shanghai Masters. Seems like an eternity ago now, doesn't it? But a real return to form, that. He went over there and he demolition job, really, wasn't it? He was superb.
Superb. Seems to have made the Shanghai Masters his own. Did I see something? He's not lost a match there since 2016.
That's ridiculous.
Did I see that?
That's ridiculous, if that's true.
I mean, I played him at least once there during that period. We played in the final, I think, just before COVID struck. Really good match. But yeah, he hasn't lost a match. And I remember him doing something similar with the old Premier League that used to tour the country. I think he won that 7 years on the bounce or something ridiculous. I mean, it's just incredible, really. But the Rocket, world number one, doing what world number ones do.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he played really well as well.
Yeah, he did. And listen, Ronnie, he touched on it, didn't he? He was talking about the big what he classes the big tournaments and turned up for those. He then pulled out of the British Open the week after. Which, to be fair, if you just gone out to Shanghai and won the Shanghai Masters, let's face it, Ronnie can do what he likes. He is the world number one.
It's interesting, though, that, because I was reading this morning, funnily enough, I was actually reading an interview that he's done with Phil Haig over at the Metro. And he's done an interview widely slating the Brentwood Centre and the English Open. And he makes a number of valid points, I think. But during one of the pieces, I think Phil split the piece into a couple of interviews. During one of them, O'Sullivan admitted that he left his queue in China following the Shanghai Masters. So did he not intend to play in the British Open at all?
That's weird, isn't it? I've not seen that interview, if I'm honest.
It was a strange one to make, because there's been no mention of any sanctions against O'Sullivan. You can only withdraw from events on medical grounds without discipline taking place. And there's been no mention of it from the association. So how did he intend to play in the English Open? Sorry, in the British Open, if his queue was in China?
With another queue, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, I suppose that could very well be the answer. Yeah.
He's played another queue. I don't know, but that
was a strange one.
Yeah, it's a bit of a strange one, isn't it? So that was the Shanghai Masters. There's been qualifiers galore. There's just one thing I'm going to pick up on the qualifiers. Liam Pullen's had a couple of wins, one over Graham Dott, which that's significant, isn't it?
Significant win, that, because Graham wouldn't give you the sweat off his nose. the amount of tough games I've had with Graham over the years. I'm not going to do it, but I do possibly the world's best Graham Dott impression.
Come on, you've got to do it now. You cannot tease the listeners like that. Let's hear your Graham Dott, Graham.
Hey, Phil, it's great to be on the podcast now, and just now I'm happy to be here and talking about all things snooker.
That sounds way too happy for Graham Dott, surely.
Sorry, that was Graham Dott after he's had a month at a spa retreat.
That was great, Graham Dott after he won the Worlds, that's what that was.
So pleased.
Fantastic, oh, well done, good work. So well done, Liam Pullen, great win. Women's UK Championship, Rhianne Evans won her 12th UK Championship to match her 12 world titles. Stunning from Rhianne. I mean, the women's game is progressing massively currently. It's coming on leaps and bounds, it really is. And she showed once again that she's got everything it takes to mix it right at the top.
Well, Great Britain and Ireland's, let's rope Ireland in at the same time. Great Britain and Ireland's most successful single player female sports person of all time, again, goes completely under the radar and wins her 12th UK title to add to her, is it 12 or 13 world titles?
It's 12, yeah, it's 12, 12 of each now. But if you're going to throw Ireland in there, there's Katie Taylor as well, the boxer. I think you've got to sort of put them together, really.
Well, how many world titles has she won?
Oh, she won the amateurs lots of times before she went professional. And bear in mind, there was no professional women's boxing for a long time. So there wasn't that opportunity. I think the two you can bracket together. And if you look at what Katie Taylor's done for women's boxing, you know, she really has been the standard bearer for women's boxing as it's gone into the professional era. I think personally, Rianne is the equivalent for snooker, and those two are right up there together.
Well, obviously, I live in Ireland, so you know, you'll have to take my word for it. But you can't move in Ireland without seeing a bus or a poster or an advert or a phone this or whatever it might be for Katie Taylor. She's everywhere, and that's my point about it. It's actually a bit of a bee in my bonnet at the moment, which regular listeners will know never happens to me. I never have anything to moan about. I think the way that Rianne Evans has been treated by not by the public, because that's it's not their fault, but I just think. The sport of snooker, and I'm not making any disparity between the women's game or the men's game here, the sport of snooker just seems to have abandoned her. It feels like they've just... In what other sport would somebody be so successful and also almost completely anonymous?
It's
incredible. I think it's really, really weird. I've known Rianne for a long, long time, get on really, really well with her. But she could, and I'm sure she wouldn't mind me saying this, I hope she doesn't, but she could walk down almost any high street in the UK and be completely unknown.
Yep.
And in my opinion, she is the most successful female British sports person in history.
Yeah.
Name me another one.
Well, yeah.
You know, name me another.
Well, as I said, I think for me, Katie Taylor, if we go saying UK and Ireland, it's Katie Taylor's up there with her. But you're right. I don't think it's a Rianne Evans thing. I think it's a women's snooker thing. And I think it's...
Correct. Yeah, no, that's what I'm saying. It's not Rianne. It's not the public. No, not at all.
And I think in time, with people like Rianne being those standard bearers, I think it'll pull it forward. It'll bring it on. You know, as I've said before, I was in Denmark a few weeks ago for a boxing unification fight, a women's unification fight, the Ring magazine title on the line as well. Now, it's not that many years ago there was no professional women's boxing. It wasn't a thing. You know, the British Boxing Board of Control would not license women, full stop. And I think the changes 100% for the better. I think it's just going to take time for it to come through. I think in 10, 20 years people will look back, or 30 years, and they'll hold Rianne Evans up as a real icon of the women's game, which by then will be on a par with the men's game for publicity and popularity and everything else. We've had some correspondence from people saying, you know, the women's game should have more publicity, more this, more that. For me, it is being pushed forward. It is being promoted more than it ever has been. We've got women on the main tour as well now, which is great. And, you know, there are efforts being made. It just takes time. You know, you're not going to suddenly get huge viewing figures for women's snooker all of a sudden, just like that. It's not going to happen. These things take time. Look at the Lionesses. Look at women's football. Women's football 10 years ago was pretty much nothing, was it? You know, it was very, very low-key, tiny crowds watching the matches, very little publicity. It started to get publicity. It started to get bigger and bigger and bigger, and it just snowballs. Women's snooker will do that. It's just going to take time, I think. And I think for Rianne, maybe unfortunately for her, she's maybe a bit early. You know, I think if Rianne, in 10 years' time, the equivalent of Rianne Evans will be a massive star. You know, there'll be a huge star. But you say that about Rianne Evans, but we had this discussion before, didn't we? A lot of snooker players, a lot of male snooker players, you know, who've won ranking titles could walk down any high street and not be recognised. They simply could. You know, Barry Hawkins walks down the street. He's not getting recognised, not by a lot of people, if any. You know, so I don't think it's really a women's snooker thing. I think it's a snooker thing. And I think it's a sport thing. We've talked about this before, haven't we? You know, it's there's a lot of sport. There's a lot of things out there, and there's everything's just diluted.
You've reminded me of a very funny story. I don't think I've shared this publicly before, but my old coach, Steve Prest, who passed away many years ago, we were at Pontins Prestatyn practicing. And I can never remember, because he passed away, you know, a few years after I'd won the Worlds. But I can never remember whether this was before that or after it, maybe the season after I might have been at Pontins qualifying for something. Probably not, because I perhaps didn't have to, but we were in there practicing late one night, and there used to be four practice tables. Any snooker players listening to this will remember this room. It was like, you know, holy ground. And we were in there practicing one night late. And, of course, it's on Pontins holiday camp. And I think they did let, you know, holiday makers use some of the tables from time to time if there was a few weeks between events for us. And we were in there practicing one night. And Steve, I don't know, he didn't recognise Barry. Barry came in and started hitting balls in the corner of the room, and he was really struggling with his game, and he wasn't getting many of the shots that he was attempting. And Steve turned around to me under his breath. He went, "Bloody hell," he said, "they're even letting holiday makers in here now." He didn't recognise Barry.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. So snooker people don't recognise Barry Hawkins. But I do think it's one of those things. But well done to Rianne. 12 UK championships to go along with the 12 world titles. Absolutely phenomenal. So moving on then, that was the UK Championships. British Open last week. Willow beat Selby in the final. What a match as well. It was superb. It really was. And it looked decent crowds down in Cheltenham again.
Yeah, really good. Mirrored here in Brentwood, of course. I only played there last night, of course, but full house. Good crowds in Cheltenham as well. It was really great. It's great to, you know, it's always great to go where you want it, isn't it? It's great to go where people turn up, pay their money and come and watch you play. And like any performers, you want to walk out to a full house. We don't want to go back to playing in front of few people, or God forbid, the, you know, the days of the lockdowns where you were playing to empty houses. That's, none of us signed up for that. So to walk out in Cheltenham at the Centaur was great again. Really good venue, great setup. Great to see, and the crowd lapped it up, and a fairly typical Willow performance in the end, you know, just shows absolutely no emotion at all.
He did afterwards though, you know, I think he was crazy, he shed a tear at the end, you know, his family came on, he looked really emotional actually, which I don't know if he's appreciating it more, or if it's hitting him a bit more as he's getting more old, a bit older, a bit later in his career. I don't know, but he did look emotional at the end, you know.
Yeah, I think that's a bit of two things. I think it's a cover story. I think sports people, you know, whilst they're also very good at their field, I think they could also be very good actors. You know, part of it is putting a show on. More so that your opponent, you don't want your opponent to get the sense of how much it means to you through the game, because they can turn the screw on you. So I think there's an element of keeping that facade up, and, you know, you would never let your opponent know how you were feeling. You would never want your emotions to boil over to the point where it affected your play.
Yep.
If you allowed, you know, the moment to mean so much, it could bother you. And Williams has almost been the master of that throughout his career. He just saunters around the table and all the balls disappear. He's been doing it for 30 years. But there has to also be the element of, you know, his children are getting a bit older now. They would have obviously grown up not fully understanding who their father was. Now they're getting to see them as young men themselves. They're getting to see who their dad is. And to be still winning titles at, what is he, 65? 67?
Hey, careful. He's only a year older than me. Yeah. Steady on, Tiger.
You know, to still be doing that and to be able to share that with your boys. Who I think play a bit of snooker themselves, yeah, yeah, by the way. And to still sort of have that rule of the roost in the house back at, you know, Cassidy Williams must be very special.
Yeah, it's brilliant. Did I tell my story from the press room at Cheltenham on this podcast or not? I think it was the World Grand Prix at Cheltenham a few years ago. And we were in the media centre and I was interviewing Kyron Wilson. Kyron had just won a match. I'm interviewing him in the media centre, and this is back when Clive Everton was still doing the commentary for ITV. And I'm mid-interview with Kyron, okay? We're chatting away, it's all being filmed for World Snooker Tour, blah, blah, blah. All of a sudden, from about 16 foot away to my right, I hear Clive Everton go, "Phil! Phil! Myself and Kyron turned around. What the hell's going on? What? Turned around, and Phil Yates was just leaving the media centre, and we just stopped completely, stopped dead. And Clive says, "Do you know where lunch is?" Completely ignorant of the fact that I was mid-interview with Kyron Wilson just over the way from him. And we're just like, what the hell? And you know, to this day, because I'm sure Clive doesn't listen to this podcast, to this day, I bet he's still not aware he even did it. Still not aware that I was interviewing Kyron Wilson. We had to stop. Myself and Kyron had a laugh, started the interview again. But it was just, yeah, completely, he was just focused on one thing, which is shouting Phil Yates and getting his lunch. So there you go. That was Cheltenham. Right, so on to the English Open, which is currently on. You've already mentioned it, Sean. You are out. You're not making any excuses, but you have mentioned your queue there, your equipment. What's going on?
Yeah, I've been suffering with it for some time, and of course, I've talked about, you know, bringing multiple queues into the fray. That is happening. That's not a bit on the back burner. That is going to happen. But I'm just not getting the spin out of the queue that I used to get. In simple terms, you know, a queue starts out. Let's say mine was just over 9 millimeters at the tip end when I got it a few years ago. It's just getting smaller every day you use it, you know, by abrasion, and it just gets smaller. So the smaller the tip and the less end mass, the less spin you get when you strike the cue ball. That's affecting my play. It's been affecting it for months and months and months. And if the playing conditions splay out of a certain set of parameters for me, I find it really difficult to get the cue ball where I want it to. So, you know, I've had to bite the bullet now and send it to John Paris and say, listen, I need you to attempt to make the tip a little bit bigger. So that involves chopping an inch or so off the top end of the cue. That makes it thicker at the top. And hopefully that'll start giving me the spin and the control of the cue ball that I'm looking for. When everything falls into place, like it did at the Players' Championships or the Tour Championships, when those playing conditions are super, what we call slippy, and the cloth's brand new and this, that and the other, I can still get it round. But you know, you only have to tap into any conversation from snooker players to listen to them talk about conditions, cloths playing heavy, this, that and the other. And the minute that starts, I struggle with my game. So I'm trying to do something about it. There's a technical problem in there. When the cue comes back, you know, it will at least tell me if the problem's me or the equipment. You know, I'll at least know. We can start moving forward again. But yeah, just to make the point, because there's always people out there wanting to, you know, throw rotten tomatoes at you. It's absolutely no excuse for certainly the loss against Lazowski last week or the loss against Liu Honghu this week. Both players played really well. And both deserve their victories. No problem with that.
It's amazing what the cue guys can do, isn't it? I was with Mark Selby doing an exhibition in Mansfield for ABC Snooker Exhibitions the other week, and he was telling me he's had, I think he said it's about 2 centimetres taking off the top end of his cue and 2 centimetres put on the bottom end. And he showed me the cue. There's no way you'd look at it and think, oh, yeah, they've stuck two centimetres on the bottom. It's amazing what they can do. Absolutely incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, well, we refer to it as a Harry Potter reference. Put the Harry Potter klaxon on. John Paris is the Ollivander of the snooker world, and what he can do with a cue is just incredible.
He's the what?
The Ollivander.
Okay. I'm guessing that's something to do with Harry Potter.
Ollivander is the wand master.
Okay.
In Harry Potter. He's the wand expert.
Never seen it. Kids film.
No.
Kids film, yeah. Kids book.
We've talked about it. But in all seriousness, again, because there will be people and not, you know, surely you can play with any cue. And of course, to some degree, that is true. But the moment you don't strike the cue ball in the middle,
yeah,
it doesn't go in a straight line.
Yeah.
So if I'm playing the cue ball with left-hand side spin, expecting the cue ball to arc on its way to the object ball, and it doesn't spin or arc as much as I'm expecting it to, that will affect the result of the shot. And if enough of those things combine, you either miss the shot or the cue ball doesn't go in the right place. And that's an equipment issue. So I'm optimistic that these things are gonna get changed, because I feel like I'm right there. I feel like my game is.
Is it trending in the right direction, Sean?
Trending in the right direction.
Look, just before we do, just go into the English Open a bit further. Let's not start trotting that one out again. We did that to death last year. You mentioned the conditions there. Now, we've discussed on this podcast so many times about big pockets. Look, pockets the same size, blah, blah, blah. It's all down to conditions. It's down to cloth and everything else. The flip side happened at Cheltenham. I saw a lot of people saying, "Those pockets are playing tight. The pockets are playing tight." It makes a change because normally people say they're playing like buckets, but no, they were saying they're playing tight. I was watching it on TV. They looked to me like they were playing very tight, especially the one as you look at it on TV, the bottom right. The amount of pots into that were missed that would never normally be missed. You always say they can't play, you know, you don't get big pockets, you don't get big pockets. Do you get tight ones?
Yeah, I mean, of course. I mean, the pockets are what we call templated. So the table fitters build the pockets to fit certain templates. So they're within, you know, there's a tolerance because behind the cloth on the cushion, behind what you can see is a strip of rubber. And that obviously has some give in it. And it's that makes the ball bounce off the cushion.
Yeah.
So what we've had here, just to try to shine some light on this, starting at Cheltenham, we started using a brand new batch of tables. Every two or three seasons, WST take delivery of a new set of tables from Star. And this new batch are slightly different.
Right.
They've been put together by the table fitters over here. It's brand new tables using brand new cushions with brand new rubber. That rubber is then hand cut to template by extremely skilled craftsmen. And the tolerance is like within fractions of millimeters. But for us, it may as well be acres because I'm used to playing that ball in the pocket and it might slip in off the cushion. Now it doesn't. And that changes the whole complex of, you know, the context of the game. Neil Robertson and I were having a conversation about this yesterday and we were saying, we're happy if the pockets are going to perform more difficult, if the pockets are going to be smaller, that suits us down to the ground because it makes it better for the better player.
Yep.
There's absolutely no question about that. And of course, I think that was borne out in the results last week in Cheltenham with two wily old characters, top tacticians, two of the best players of all time in the final, who fought their way through. Tighter pockets will suit prone, you know, old Wily Fox characters such as your Higginses and your Selbys and your Williamses and Ronnie and people like that. No question about that. And it does look, again, from what I've seen here at Brentwood this week, it looks like that's set to continue. But it's important. I certainly wasn't criticising the table fitters or the conditions. The conditions last week in Cheltenham were lovely.
Yeah.
They were, again, but they are different. There's no question that they are different. And it looks like that difference is here to stay.
There you go. So let's go to the English Open then. Brentwood this week. I'll be there later in the week. I'm there from the quarterfinals onwards. So Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Say hello if you're going. You are out. We've mentioned that already. Stan Moody, Mini Sean. Oh, deciding frame last night against the world champion, the world junior champion against the world champion, Luca Brissell. And Luca just edged him out, didn't he? What an experience for Stan.
That matchup can't have happened very often, the world junior champion against the world champion in a professional match.
You wouldn't have thought so, would you?
Comparisons have been made between Stan and I, obviously. We've had the DNA test, I can confirm.
You are his
dad. There is no relation. I'm his dad. Luke.
Stan, I am your father.
Stan, search your feelings. And I have to admit that there was a certain element of pride out watching him come out last night on table one, centre stage against Luca. I was on the next table and it was difficult for me not to look over the barrier and watch a bit of him in play when I was, you know, not playing myself. Very aware as our match pushed to a decider, their match was pushed to a decider. I think Luca and Stan both had chances in the decider.
Yeah.
That would be fair to say. And it looked like it went down to the pink. And one shot cost Stan in the end. He played a safety shot, didn't get it right, and Luca put the match to bed. But great experience for the young man. Hasn't won a match yet on tour. Got a draw in one of his Championship League matches, yet to get that first win. I do think when he gets one, he'll get a few.
Yeah, I agreed 100%. What was lovely last night was
after the match, the amount of fans who came down wanting to shake Stan's hand. And fair play to him. He's just lost in a deciding frame against the world champion. And he stuck around and he shook all those hands. And it's great to see that he's getting that recognition from the snooker fans who, let's face it, they're an educated bunch. They know their stuff. And, you know, they know when they're looking at someone who's got real talent and ability. And, yeah, it's great to see him getting a bit of credit. But all good experience, isn't it?
Yeah, fabulous. You know, and these are the days... These are the days he'll look back on in years to come as his career progresses. You know, I hope he learns the little snippets of nuggets of gold that are in that match. He needs to watch these matches back. He needs to analyse his performance, where it went right, where it went wrong. And it's all those little, you know, we're talking about fractions of percentage points that can be the difference between wins and losses. So good to see. Not 100% sure when his next trip out. I don't think he's not in Wuhan like myself. Probably the Northern Irish Open will be the next time he's at bat. And hopefully he'll come back swinging.
I'm sure he will do. Now, you mentioned Neil Robertson there. You said you were chatting to Neil about the tables. Lost out to Sanderson Lam yesterday. Taking nothing away from Sanderson Lam, by the way. Played very, very well. Put a fine performance together and striking the ball very, very well. But Robbo's struggling, isn't he?
Yeah, well, like, you know, I mean, it might be unfair criticism. He appears to be struggling. We revealed, I think, a few weeks ago that he's working with Chris Henry now. And I know from personal experience that, you know, when you take on board a new coach and the new information that that coach brings to your team, it can sometimes take a bit of time for that to bed in and settle in. And you might see results on the practice table, but it can take weeks, if not months, for that to percolate through into your game actually in the arena. So Neil might be suffering a bit of a hangover of new information. He might just be running into players who play really well. I have to say, I think Sanderson is developing into a real stalwart of the tour. I think he's becoming almost like, not the forgotten man, but people don't talk about Sanderson.
He played very well yesterday. I watched that match.
He's a proper player, Sanderson.
Yeah, like. I watched that match and he played very, very well yesterday. Do you think that is what we're seeing, though? Do you think we're seeing the transition? Because like you said, it's like golfers. If a coach comes in and changes a golfer's swing, they don't immediately get it. It takes time for it to get right. And then once they get there, they then see the benefit. Do you think there is a chance that is what we're seeing with Neil? Do you think we are seeing a transition as Chris is coming in and making a few changes to his game, and then once that clicks, we'll see an uplift?
Very hard to say, isn't it? I mean, it's either that or it's just a case of everything's fine. And a bit like I suffered with last season, you just keep running into people playing out their skin.
Yeah, yeah.
It's one or the other. Of course, and I did say this to Chris when he started working with Neil. Like any improvement with somebody like Neil Robertson, you know, can only be marginal. This is one of the best players of all time. You know, we're talking about the most successful non-British player, the most successful left-hander, geographically challenged, I think we could say. Yep. That would be fair. And I did congratulate him yesterday on making back-to-back venues correctly. I mean, that's good. Progress is being made. Whilst we're on that, can we just make a little segue into the weird, wonderful world of Ding Junhui?
Yeah, go on. What happened? Did you have the wrong trousers on? Did you go a bit Wallace and Gromit on as well? What's going on there?
Whilst we're talking about, you know, players' preparation and not Neil not making the right venue, I think he has, when he has made the right venues, he's at least taken the correct dress code with him.
Well, right. Now, all I saw, I was working, I think, and I saw a note on the match. Ding, docked the first frame or one frame, for turning up late, I think, was the official line on there. I then read that he had the wrong trousers on. Go on, Sean, enlighten us. What happened?
So my understanding of the story, having done minimal research, you know, I wasn't there, but my understanding is that because he turned up in the wrong attire, he turned up with his brown suit on and a white shirt and a bow tie.
Ah, okay.
Is the wrong dress code because he turned up like that. I think he sent his PA out to search for a pair of black pants and a black shirt in Brentwood. you know, at 9:15 on a Monday morning. By the time that person came back, the match was late starting. He wasn't ready. He caused the match to start late, so he was docked the first frame. Now we went ahead, and I think he won the match 4-3 in the end.
He did. It was tight, all, yeah, very tight
as well. But imagine turning up with the wrong gear on. I mean, it's just incredible.
How many years now has the home nation's been black trousers, black shirt? By the way,
yeah, nobody likes change.
No. So there's been lots of other matches in the English Open. One that I just want to touch on is Mark Allen. Won 4-0, four centuries. Second player to have done that after Neil Robertson, which was quite a few years ago now. He came off the table, he was interviewed by World Snooker Tour, and he said that he's never been so low in confidence. Huh?
Yeah. That.
How does that work?
Yeah, well, such is the mind of a snooker player, you know, you just wouldn't know. I mean, it's, I know I've churned out some really good performances, but felt terrible.
Yeah.
And on the flip side of that, gone out into arenas feeling like an absolute world beater and played horrific. So I sort of, you know, you give him the benefit of the doubt, played really well, four centuries, but feeling low on confidence. Only Mark will know what he means by that. That's a snooker player's logic for you.
If he can get his confidence up, though, and he's playing like that, goodness me, he's going to be absolutely lethal.
Yeah, I know. How will he be when he's got his confidence up? That's the question, isn't it? But
crazy.
Yeah, it shone more light on my own performance, really, in my game, because, you know, if Mark Allen can make four centuries, and I can't make any, goodness, like, troubling times, isn't it?
Well, let's see what happens. Let's see what happens when you get that cue back and things get going again. Anyway, the English Open continues all week, finishes on Sunday. It's live on Eurosport and Discovery Plus. There are still some tickets available, I believe. I think the final on Sunday is sold out. Other than that, there are tickets available for the Brentwood Centre. So wst.tv/tickets. As I said, I'll be there from Friday. If you are going and you're there on Friday, Saturday or Sunday, come and say hello. I'm always pottering around somewhere in the arena. So pop down and say hello if you are there. So that's the English Open. Enjoy that this week. We've had some correspondence that's actually really interesting, and we're going to talk about it in just a few moments' time.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
You're listening to the 147 podcast with Sean Murphy and Phil Seymour. If you like what you're listening to, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and be sure to interact with us across all forms of social media at 147pod. That's the words at 147pod.
And one person who has done that on several occasions is Cameron Pentland. Now, on the last podcast, someone posed the question, how about matches being decided on points totals rather than frames? And we talked about this. We had a real good discussion about it. Right, Cameron has emailed in. Hi, guys. Just following up on the question about snooker matches being decided on points total rather than frames scored. As a PhD student in mathematics and big snooker fan, I thought I'd have a quick look. What a great start to an email. So here we go. Right. Looking only at world finals from 1980 until now, we would have had five very different results. 1984, Jimmy White scored 136 more points than Steve Davis. So based on that, Jimmy White would have his world title. 85, Davis scored 68 points more than Taylor at the 85 final. 86, Davis scored 63 points more than Joe Johnson, would have wiped out Joe Johnson's world title. 97, Hendry scored 114 more than Ken. And in 2011, Judd Trump scored a massive 198 more than John Higgins. So Cameron's put the takeaways from this. Jimmy at last picks up a world title. Steve takes his total to 7. Hendry takes his to 8, one ahead of Ronnie. Although, sadly, this means that Dennis, Joe and Ken all lose out. Trump takes his tally to 2, whilst Higgins drops down to 3. We should note that this only accounts for the finals themselves, as the players in them may not have even reached a final if we did the same analysis on the semis, quarters, etc. And Cameron says it will be interesting to see how a tournament using total points might work in the future. Looking forward to a good season and more great content on the pod. Cheers, Cameron Pentland. Cameron, firstly, thank you for taking the time and effort to do that. And Sean, some interesting results there, isn't there?
Very interesting. As you were reading that out, examples of matches where people have scored more points but actually lost. You know, a couple of matches of mine, Brian, we mentioned him earlier on, but I remember losing a semi-final in the German Masters to Graham Dott. Yep. 2017, something like that. 2018. And I was ahead in every stat. I won every stat. Pot success, points scored, balls potted, best shoes. You know.
best Graham Dott impression.
Hey, I played really well. Game. I've got a feeling as well. I've got a feeling the same happened last week against Jack Lazowski. I've got a feeling I was ahead in every start in that match as well and lost.
Yeah.
So I think there's an element of, you know, it's not that stats don't lie, but they can certainly be interpreted. Cameron admits himself that this only takes into account the finals. The said players in that update, they might not have even been in the finals if they were outscored by their opponents along the way. But it is interesting, isn't it? The thing that stood out for me, and this was a slightly opposite, you know, bearing in mind the 1985 World Final went down to the last ball.
Yeah.
There was only 68 points in it. I mean, that's incredible, isn't it? That is, like, if you just think about that for a minute, they played all 35 frames to the last ball, and he was only 68 points ahead.
Yeah. It's crazily incredible. Close, isn't it? Crazily close.
Crazily
it's such
close.
A long, such a long match. It's it is a bit mad, that, isn't it? It's a little bit.
The
mad.
Amount of times, I've got to see it now as a pundit. But you see, as the World Championship develops, you get the two players into the semis, and then more stats come out, and they'll say, like, you know, total points through the championship, and the players usually are within 50 to 100 points of each other.
Yeah, it's mad, isn't it?
It is mad, like, you know, when you start thinking about it. So, yeah, I like stuff like this. I like data. I like people looking into this. Cameron, thank you for doing it. You know, crack on, you know. As a PhD student, you know, sack your PhD off. This is the information we need. Don't worry about staying up, going to your lectures and putting effort into what you're trying to do. Forget that. We need you to put your effort into solving these problems.
Yeah, there you go. Careers advice from Sean Murphy. That's what everyone needs right now, isn't it? Goodness me.
follow Sean for more career advice.
I still don't think it'll ever happen. I still don't think they'll ever go away from frames to total points. I just don't think it'll ever be a thing. I think we have frames. It's what we do.
It's been a thing over the years on the exhibition tour. I think I might have even mentioned this on the pod before, but I know for definite that Ian McCulloch, yep, and Joe Perry back in the day both used to offer a form of exhibition to promoters where they would come and give your club 500 head start and take on your 10 best players and beat the club on the night.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
That's been done.
So there you go. Cameron, thank you for that. I found that very interesting. I hope the listeners did as well. Sean, have you got a rant?
Do you know what? I haven't.
You haven't got a rant.
I'm
okay.
Feeling quite zen.
That's
I'm feeling,
fine.
I'm feeling quite zen, and I've got enough problems in the world at the moment without ranting. So
that's absolutely.
I don't
can't
have a rant this week.
Can't rant if he hasn't got his cue. That's what it is. Okay, let's get on to listener questions then. I'll kick us off. Don Smith or Smythe. Sorry, Don, if I've got your surname wrong. On Twitter, is the two cushion thin contact safety shot the hardest and highest risk shot? Ronnie effectively won the 2020 semi against Selby using it, but surely it's got to be a last resort.
Yeah, I'm assuming from that that's the shot where you hit the two cushions first and then hit the object ball.
Yes.
Not sure.
I'm not sure either.
I'm not sure. Yeah, I mean, you know, you would never choose to hit cushions first before you strike the object ball, unless you can't see the object ball. If you can see it, you would always choose to hit it first. So from that point of view, it would be high risk. But this has one foot in a subject Neil and I were talking about yesterday. Again, we covered quite a lot of ground, and we were talking about the misrule. And we were saying how it's funny, the misrule has kind of, it's ended up encouraging the very things it was brought in to sort of get rid of from the game, which was that deliberate miss element, really. I mean, some of the deliberate misses on show on YouTube footage from the 80s and early 90s is quite frankly laughable. It's hilarious, some of the shots played in the 1985 final frame, for instance. They were just deliberate, you know. Actually really funny to watch it back. Falfour, your turn. And, you know, it's just incredible. So the misrule was brought in to stamp that out. But what it has encouraged, in my opinion, is this professional foul now, where I will, you know, and so will all the other players, you will seek to clip a very fine edge of an object ball. And just move your target in, you know, just closer to the ball. And you're going to get two free goes at it if you can see it. So I don't like it. I think it's time the rule went. I know that wasn't the question. The two cushion thin contact is very high risk. And Ronnie is very good at using it.
Seeing as you've gone on to the misrule there, there's a bit of controversy the other week with Selby, I think? Who made several attempts to get out of a snooker, and it kept being called a miss. And I think there was an argument, a very strong argument actually, that it wasn't a miss at all, that he went for the shot and he wasn't trying to gain an advantage by putting the cue ball where he put it. There's quite a hoo-ha on social media about it. And do you think the misrule is defaulted to now? When it shouldn't be, things should be taken into account, and it should actually be thought about. It seems to be immediately foul and a miss. Foul and a miss. It should be foul and a miss. You know,
I'm not 100% sure of the wording of the miss, but my understanding of it is that there is an element of judgment on the referee's behalf to decide whether you've made a good attempt and the difficulty of the shot and all these other factors. I don't think it's a case of if you miss the object ball, it's a miss. But the problem with that is that then leads into that referee's own individual understanding of the game, what shots are possible, what shots aren't possible, the level of difficulty. And with respect, a large portion of the referees aren't qualified to make that call. They're qualified to referee the snooker match and to adhere to the rules, but not necessarily qualified to speak to what shots are more difficult than others. Whether that angle that the player's trying to get is possible. I think they're able to say whether a player is trying to hit the ball on purpose or not, and whether they sense an infringement of that rule. But that's one of my issues with the misrule, is it's open to interpretation from a referee who, with the greatest will in the world, may never have played snooker before.
Yeah, it just seems to default immediately foul and a miss. You said, you know, there's a consideration in that. I think a lot of the time there isn't a consideration. I think it's just called straight away. And I don't know, you know, the Selby one the other day, whether it's right or wrong, I don't know. As you said, I'm not a player, so I can't look at it from a player's perspective. But there was certainly a lot around it. What do you think out there listening at 147 Pod across all social media? Does the misrule need changing? Is it fit for purpose or not? Does it work? So anyway, let's move on, Sean.
Valis Commando on Twitter says, are there any other sports where participants are constantly scrabbling around for visas, or is it just snooker? Yeah, see, this relates to what was happening before the Shanghai Masters. And I know that a lot of players are now going through for Wuhan. Obviously, you know, before that whole period of time, we all had these multi-entry, go as many times as you want visas. They've all run out since. So we've all been scrambling around trying to get them back. I have to tell my story if I haven't already told it.
You haven't.
Did I tell it?
No, you haven't. You nearly did, and we had a technical error, and we'd actually lost that section of the podcast. So go on.
I must tell this story. It's hilarious. But in fairness, To answer the question before I go rambling off on this story, I do think this is something that everybody, whether they're business people, holiday makers, travellers, sports, but whatever they're doing, you know, we don't have freedom of movement around the world, visa-less travel. We don't live in that world. And you do have to fill in the correct forms and all the rest of it to be granted travel. Now, the business visa that we have to use as players to go to China is more complicated than a tourist visa. My PA, Robbie, managed to make a meal of his visa. He was just getting a tourist visa. Very nearly didn't get one. But, you know, the business visa is quite a long, drawn-out process. And it requires, you know, fingerprints and all the rest of it. So I had to go to London for mine, you know, which living in Dublin wasn't straightforward. Filled out this massive 15, 20-page document. They wanted to know, like, you know, where my mother was born and what her maiden name was and my dad and this, that and the other and what my dog walker's auntie's best friend was called and my inside leg measurement and, you know, all this other stuff. And it was just starting to get a bit of a long, drawn-out process. And it was getting really close to when I'd have to go to Shanghai. And, of course, around that time, I had to go to Nuremberg as well, needed the passport. And so I had to go for this meeting at not the Chinese embassy, but the visa office in London. And when I walked in this place should have had 200 people in it, and there were 600 people in it.
Wow.
It was like Borough Market. It was incredible. I'm meeting my liaison officer from a company we use for our visas, recommended by World Snooker. I meet this guy. My appointment's at 11:15. And we go downstairs, and there's another 600 people downstairs. And it was incredible. And as we went downstairs, I see, sat down on the left-hand side, a couple of staff members from Matchroom, a couple of the announcers and callers from the PDC. You know, the ones with the really gruff voice. And sat on his own was Neil Robertson.
Did he have a beanie hat on?
He did have a hat on, as it happened.
Yeah, he always has a beanie hat on.
Always has a hat on. And he sat there, and he'd been sat there for, I think, an hour and a half to 2 hours.
Wow.
And he looked like his world had ended. So my liaison officer says to me, yeah, what you have to do is you take your folder of your documents up to that hatch, the window of destiny. They check all your paperwork, and they will give you a ticket. And it's like the old deli counter ticket. You take your ticket, and you have to wait your turn. He said, I'm sorry, the current wait is 2 to 3 hours.
Oh, wow.
So I'm like, oh, my word. You know, do I really want to go to the Shanghai Masters? I'm starting to consider my future at this point. So anyway, I go and takes the seats, and I take the thing over to the thing, and the fella looks through all my paperwork, and he stamps it, and he says, yeah, that all's in order. Great, thanks very much. And he stamps it, and he gives me my ticket. And as he gives me the ticket, this lady walks past, and she gives me the look, and I, when somebody recognises you, you do notice it.
Yeah.
And there was definitely a moment. So anyway, I take my seat, and I take my ticket, and I wait, and I'm in for the long haul. I've got 2 to 3 hours. This woman approaches through the crowd. She comes out, and she's got her lanyards on, and she approached. She said, are you Sean Murphy? I said, yes. She said, you're my favourite snooker player. So, I'm immediately on alert.
Yeah, she's obviously mental. There's something weird going on there, isn't there?
She's obviously a weirdo.
Yeah, she's never seen snooker in her life. Carry on.
Doesn't know the other thing. So she says, you're my favourite player. She said, would you mind having a picture? I said, yeah, no problem. So this assistant of hers appears out of nowhere with her phone, and she puts her arm around my shoulder, and I put my arm around hers, and we have a picture. And she slips a piece of paper into my hand.
Oh, yeah.
She surely hasn't passed me her number, or that hasn't. She's not hit on me like in the visa office. And she turns around and she's given me another ticket. She said, "You're next." So my 3 hour wait has just evaporated on the spot.
Oh wow!
And as she said, "You're next," my ticket number appeared on the screen, and she said, there you are, take a seat.
And there's, so sorry, just a second, and there's Neil Robertson in his beanie hat sat there for an hour and a half already.
Meanwhile, the camera, Scorsese, if he's filming this, Scorsese pans the camera around to the PDC crew, and Neil sat there crying in the corner.
No.
So I've walked up to the window, and I can feel Neil's eyes burning into the back of my skull. And the fella stamps all my documents, and he says, I've been instructed by the boss to offer you the gold standard 5-year multi-entry business visa.
Oh, that's diamonds. That's great stuff.
You know, diplomats don't get that.
Nice.
So he said, would you like it? It's an extra £50. I said, yes, please. stamp, seal, delivered, done. He said, that's you, done. He said, your passport will be back in 3 days. Have a great day.
Wow.
I was in the building 15 minutes. And I walked right. It took everything I had not to moonwalk past Neil Robertson. No.
Have you spoke to Neil about it?
He said, where are you going? I said, that's me done. He said, have a great day. And bounced up the stairs.
Oh, wow. So there you go. If you want to look for corruption, Chinese embassy. Oh, that's incredible. That really is. Wow, what a story. Okay. So, yeah, Valleys Commando. Other sports, darts, I think, by the sound of things. But no, not really. Solid147 on Instagram. Do you practice your concentration off the table as you do on it? If so, what would you recommend, as I want to improve my game and you're a big inspiration? I think he's talking to you there.
Well, that's thank you. That's lovely. Thank you, Solid147. Yeah, I mean, the answer is yes. Definitely do. I remember years and years ago, 20 years ago or more, being on what they called the Young Players of Distinction course. And part of that, we got 2 days with Terry Griffiths, who was like, he was the don of coaching back then. And remember he said, like, you know, how much of snooker do you think is mental versus technical? And I said, oh, it's probably 80-20 mental. And he said, right. He said, but you know, you might spend 6 or 7 hours a day practicing the technical side, and that only accounts for 20%. How much time do you spend practicing the mental side? And of course, the answer was none. And that led me into it. And I remember him saying this. It's one of the few things I do remember. But, you know, obviously in snooker, you're constantly putting out fires. You're constantly dealing with stuff that's going wrong. And I remember clearly one of the examples he used was when you're driving and somebody cuts you up, next time that happens, try not to react. Try to keep calm under pressure. When things do go wrong, you don't know what's happening in that person's life. They are probably driving like an idiot. But they could well also be on a rush to a hospital appointment, or, you know, his wife could be pregnant, or whatever. Try to keep, you know, on top of your emotions. Now, obviously, I can hear people screaming at their devices. That's much easier said than done. There's absolutely no question about that. But I do remember very, very early on, he was very, very keen on practicing concentration. And I remember when Mark Selby first teamed up with Mukesh Parma, who was kind of his mentor through his sort of early to mid-professional career. Mukesh had him take up Sudoku.
Really?
Yeah, as a means of keeping him focused and practicing his concentration for long periods of time. You know, on flights, traveling in hotels, he'd be sat in coffee shops. He'd always have his Sudoku book with him or on the app. And it was a means of him keeping his mind, testing his mind, training his mind to be able to concentrate for long periods of time.
Wow, that's bizarre. Do you know, I'm going to go a little bit dark on us here, which we don't often do on the podcast. When you said about the if someone cuts you up, don't lose your rag. I remember a former colleague of mine, I used to cover the Northeast, he covered the Northwest, and he rang me up one day and he sounded a bit weird, he sounded a bit shocked, and he said, you know, like when someone cuts you up and you bib your horn or you make a gesture at them. I said, yeah. He says, yeah, don't do that anymore. And I said, why? And he'd been in traffic in Liverpool that day, and the car in front of him had been cut up by a car in front of him. And this guy had papped his horn and clearly gestured. The guy in the car in front got out of his car, walked to the car behind, opened the door, shot the guy in the leg. Just literally out of nowhere. And my colleagues sat in his car watching this happen. Shot the guy in his leg, put the gun in his pocket, got back in his car and drove off. And he said to me, he said, Phil, he said, we all do it. He said, but just, you don't know who that person is. And he said, you've no idea who that person is. He said, I don't think there's any more to it than the fact that he cut him up, he papped his horn and gestured or whatever. And this guy happened to be that kind of person that had a gun or whatever. And he literally got out of his car, walked behind, shot him in the leg, back in his car, drove off. And he said to me, he said, don't do it. He said, next time someone cuts you up, he said, just suck it up. And I thought, wow. I mean, dark for our podcast. We don't normally go there, but scary, isn't it? It does make you think.
Scary world, yeah. You don't know who's around you, do you? And of course, like, you know, I mean, I'd love to meet a couple of people who do more miles than we do. I mean, every time I message you or speak to you, you're in the car. I'm all over the place, driving constantly. And one of the things, I think, as you get a bit older, obviously, we've both got children, you become aware it's not also just you, is it? And it's everyone else. Like,
absolutely,
you know,
yeah.
You know, drive safe. Well, I mean, I will drive safe, but they might not. We've gone deep there.
Yeah, sorry about that.
didn't see that coming.
There you go. It does make you think. Anyway, look, let's have a couple more questions because we're just coming up to the hour. So what have we got, Sean?
Jake Squid over on Instagram says, should high brake prizes be included in the rankings money list? What other alterations would you make to the way the rankings are decided?
I think it's a great question. If there were, as a player, I'll frame it this way then. If there were, do you think that might shift focus slightly, or do you think players are always going for the highest break anyway?
Yeah, it's funny because I always think the high break prize is slightly out of balance to the tournament that's being played. For instance, this week at the English, and I only noticed this yesterday because it was on the marketing hoarding around the players' lounge. I'm sure the highest break this week's $5,000.
I think it is, yeah.
For a player to earn that or more this week, I think they've got to get to the quarterfinals.
Right, okay.
I think, something like that. Or maybe the last 16. That doesn't feel... Now I'm saying it, that doesn't feel right. But you've certainly got to win two or three matches, I think, to earn over and above 5,000, to be dipping into the 10,000 region. In pure prize money terms, for the highest break to carry quite a significant amount, certainly more than winning your first round, possibly second round, would be interesting, because would you see players take on a slightly more attacking approach, you know, playing for the pinks and blacks a little bit more often? Would it encourage that, you know, going for the high? Yeah, I get it. I'm not against it. I think I had the highest break in three events last season, so I'd love it.
It's funny, isn't it, when it comes to the end of the season and, you know, the difference between a player staying on tour and a player dropping off tour is tiny amounts of money, isn't it? You know, it's often very small amounts of prize money. That could make a massive difference to one player or two players. That could make a huge difference, and... I don't know.
I know players that have fallen off tour and lost their playing privileges by £75.
That's crazy, isn't it? That's frightening.
You know, they've missed the line by a frame-winning break.
Wow. So in that instance, that's going to make a life difference. You know, it's a huge difference.
That could make
it?
A massive, so... massive difference. In terms of changes, we've talked about this before. It's been widely talked about. It's not a secret. You know, there is a move amongst the players to try to negotiate with WST to consider perhaps not even returning to a points-based ranking system, but running one concurrently with a money list and using them for different things. There is a feeling that using prize money for the rankings sort of imbalances things slightly, although... You know, when the switch to money list took place, the rankings didn't change that much.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
maybe it's all, you know, whimsical and not real. But it's difficult in a world where somebody wins an event. There was some. This might have been anecdotal, but it felt the case. Like when I won the Gibraltar Open years and years ago, I don't remember going up the rankings.
Right.
And if anything, I think I might have even gone backwards. Because at the time the rankings review that was made a week or two later, I was defending points from an event that no longer existed. I think I won €20,000 for winning the Gibraltar Open, something like that. And it wasn't enough to keep me at the place to keep parity with where I'd been the year before. Now, in a points-based system, that tournament is awarded the same amount of points as another set of events, not as glorified as the UK's or the world's. There has to be a level for it, of course. You can't really have a system where you win an event and go down. That shouldn't really happen. And as I say, that might be slightly anecdotal. I don't remember climbing at pace anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I didn't go up by 5 spots, 10 spots, whatever. As I think you do see winners now when they win events. They do climb up a little bit. There is that feeling now. We would, as a body of players, I think, like to see the rankings go back to a points-based system.
Do you think it will?
I don't think it will, no. Because I think WST have made the case and can make the case well that a switch to a money list and the incentives that that has given new promoters and new tournaments around the world to bump up their prize money in a bid to make their events bigger and better has made the tour bigger and better.
Yep.
I think WST can make that case very well. And it is incumbent on the players now, if they want to try and get that change, the board of WPBSA players, WPBSA as well, they're going to have to make a good, strong argument against that. And that's difficult to make.
So answer the question then. Should high break prizes be included in the rankings money list?
Yes.
Yes. There you go. Right. You've used the word whimsical. I've used the term hoo-ha. So I think it's time to come to the end of the listener questions. We have got some left. We will hold them over for the next podcast. If you have got any questions for us, please get them into us at 147pod, all words at 147pod, across all forms of social media. We do get as many in as we possibly can. We are just over the hour though, so it's time just to do our pointless question for today, which we have on every podcast. This is a very simple one, Sean. The age old, eternal, massive question of life. Marmite, yes or no?
No.
Oh, it's a big yes for me.
A big yes.
Big yes. Yeah.
Hang on. Graham, what do you think?
Oh, no, I hate Marmite. Can he stand it? It's absolute filth.
And as Graham Dot makes his return, that is definitely the end of the podcast. So I am a big yes for Marmite. Sean's a big no. Graham Dot, do you know what? The next time we see Dotty, we'll have to ask him. Sean, what's next for you?
Well, some sad news for me. I've had a number of very close people pass away in the last couple of weeks. My best friend of the first half of my life, Gillian Denton, as I knew her, she was Gillian Beckley in her later life, passed away last week. We're going to be burying her within the next couple of weeks. And a relative of mine in New York passed away over the weekend. And maybe it's serendipity, but having now lost in the English Open, that means I can jump on a plane and go and attend that funeral and represent the family in the States. So I shall be jumping on a flight tomorrow and heading to NYC.
Well, safe travels, and I hope they go as well as they possibly can. Obviously not a nice thing to have to go and do. Hope they go
yourself,
as well as they can.
What are you up to?
English Open for me. I am got a couple of days off now. This is Tuesday lunchtime as we're recording this. A couple of days off, and then I head down to Brentwood on Thursday. On the mic Friday, Saturday, Sunday down there, and thoroughly looking forward to it. My first tournament of the season. And yeah, cannot wait. I had an exhibition with Selby the other week. So getting nicely back into the snooker groove. And yeah, really looking forward to it. So from the quarterfinals on Friday through to the end of the final on Sunday, I'll be down there in Brentwood. If you're there as well, do come and say hello. That was the 147 podcast. Sean, great to see you.
You too. Hey, okay, bye.
Cheers, Graham. Take care. That was the 147 podcast with Sean Murphy and Phil Seymour. If you enjoyed what you've just listened to, make sure you subscribe, leave us a review, and interact with us across all forms of social media at 147pod. That's all words at 147pod. Thanks for listening.